From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. If you do an internet search for universities and sexual harassment and assault, up pop the policies of Harvard, Yale, Penn, Stanford, Cal, and the like. UC Berkeley's policy states that such behavior is prohibited both by law and by policy at the university itself. And those who file a complaint will receive a prompt and effective response. But on Wednesday, several UC students testified at the state capitol that their complaints had been ignored, prompting the legislature to authorize an investigation. Nationwide, there is growing concern about the prevalence of sexual violence on campus, and in the hour ahead, we'll take a look at what's being done to confront that problem. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. They're among America's most prestigious colleges and universities: Yale, Dartmouth, Princeton, USC, Notre Dame. But this is not a list any of those schools want to be on. It's a list of schools who have been accused of not responding appropriately to sexual violence and sexual harassment complaints on campus. And this week, it was UC Berkeley's turn to be scrutinized after a number of Berkeley students testified before a legislative committee that their complaints had gone unheeded. The state legislature, in response, authorized an investigation. Nationwide, according to statistics cited in a United States Department of Education memo, 1 in 5 college students, college women rather, say that they were the victims of sexual assault or attempted sexual assault. So are college campuses doing enough to respond? In this hour Forum, we want to examine the problem of campus sexual assault and harassment, what's happening, and what should be done to confront that problem. Joining us first is Sophie Karasik. She's a junior studying political economy at UC Berkeley and was one of the students who testified at the legislature this week. Sophie, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So your incident happened in an off-campus trip in February of last year when you were awakened in the middle of the night by an unwanted sexual advances, I guess is maybe the polite way perhaps to put it. Tell us what you did after that in terms of trying to get the attention of the university.
Sure. So at first it was really difficult for me because I was at this off-campus trip with a lot of people that I didn't know very well. And they expressed to me that what had happened was a problem. And when I got back to the university, they encouraged me to actually file a report with the university. And so first we had him resign from his leadership position in the club, and in hopes of discouraging him from any future behavior. And a couple weeks later, he actually sexually assaulted somebody else. And so we reported, four of us reported the same assailant to the university in hopes that it would initiate an investigation and prevent him from doing this again. And we were not informed until 7 months later that there had actually been any sort of investigation. We were not contacted.
And so during that time, you heard nothing, and you finally then followed up to the office on campus and said, what's going on?
Yes. So I had heard through mutual friends that he was set to graduate a semester early from the university, and I was quite surprised that the university had not told me this. And so I reached out to them myself to inquire into my own case and figure out what had happened. And they sent me 2 3-sentence emails, one of which said that he had been found in violation of the student code of conduct, and the other that said that the case had been solved through an early resolution process. And in the policies, it says that the goal of an early resolution is to resolve concerns at the earliest stage possible with the cooperation of all parties involved. And also that it includes an inquiry into the facts, but typically not include a formal investigation. And I was not part of this process at all after the first initial meeting. I was not contacted, even though I said that I had more evidence to provide, and there was certainly not the cooperation of all parties involved. Had I known that nothing was happening, I would have contacted them much earlier.
And did you get any information about what that resolution involved when it says that there was a violation of the code of conduct and that there was a resolution that was achieved? Was any more detail provided to you as to what that actually meant?
No. I still don't know what's happened in my own case in terms of whether or not there have been any disciplinary sanctions. And actually, there is an obligation legally to notify survivors of the outcome of campus disciplinary proceedings that are involved in sexual assault.
And Sophie, tell me something more about what motivated you and your fellow students to testify before the state legislature this week, as far as the way in which the incident that happened to you, both the incident itself and then, in your view, the lack of response from the university, as to how widespread that is. Give me your sense of how large a problem this is on the UC Berkeley campus.
Sure. So actually, over the past year, there was a 95% increase in reported rape and sexual assault. And so this has been a very pervasive problem over a number of years, but also more people are coming forward, but there are also more cases. And so I actually did a lot of research into what Berkeley's history of sexual violence is, and we found that in 1979, a coalition of women known as Women Organized Against Sexual Harassment actually filed a Title IX complaint against Berkeley in connection to a professor who was preying upon his own students. And this professor was ultimately had to resign. However, the federal Title IX complaint wasn't the reason for why that happened. It was the pressure from the media that ultimately
So your sense is that this has been a problem at UC Berkeley for many decades. And so what at this point do you want the university, what would you like the university to do to focus more on this problem? What would you like to have happen so that your last 2 years at the university are ones where you feel comfortable being a student on that campus?
I think that right now, we need to encourage the university to support survivors and discipline offenders, because right now, neither of these things are happening. For instance, at our medical centers, they don't actually provide rape kits, and there have been cases of students who go to our medical center and then are not told of their medical options, which is also a legal obligation that they have. And so when offenders are not being disciplined and supporters and survivors are not being supported, this is creating a campus climate issue and a public safety issue. And so in my own case, I didn't have the ability to appeal the decision that was made. There's currently no appeals process, and also there's not a procedure for which survivors can request a formal hearing. And so a couple of the things that we really want the university to focus on are making sure that both survivors and the accused have the same right to due process for a formal investigation, and really making sure that the survivors are supported through the process, because there's actually on the website a flow chart for what to do if you're accused of sexual violence, but there is not a similar flow chart for what to do if you're a survivor. And so when you are looking to the university to support you, making sure that the university is adequately providing this is crucial.
Sophie Karasik, a junior studying political economy at UC Berkeley, one of the students who testified before the state legislature this morning. Sophie, best of luck to you in your continuing career at UC Berkeley. Hope all goes well for you in the years ahead.
Thank you so much.
We're joined now by two individuals from the University of California, Berkeley. Denise Oldham is the director of the Title IX officer for the campus and the Office for the Prevention of Harassment and Discrimination, and Claudia Cavello, executive director of the University Health Services at UC Berkeley. Thanks both very much, both of you, for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's pick up on one of the things that Sophie said and Claudia Covello about the university not providing rape kits to students who say they have been sexually assaulted. Again, we should be clear in her case, in Sophie's case, there was not a rape involved. Is that accurate, that rape kits are not provided? And if so, why not?
Yeah, I was very sorry to hear of her experience or that she has that perception, because it is very much our practice to facilitate the medical care and ensure students get to appropriate evidence collection, and it's certainly our value as well. So let me explain a little bit more about that. We encourage survivors to have an exam to preserve evidence in case it's needed later. Rape kits are part of a forensic exam. It's a very highly specialized service that trained professionals get certified in and get mastery and expertise in. So our role at University Health Services is to make sure that we facilitate the survivor to the right facility who have sexual assault response teams that have the specialized training.
I see. So in this case, your job at the health service would be to make sure if a student says she has been raped, to get that person to another health facility that could provide that service. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. In Alameda County, that is designated as Highland Hospital, that has the sexual assault response team, and the Bay Area Against Women is sends the advocate to stand by the survivor's side. Law enforcement is involved because this is evidence collection and there are procedures for a chain of evidence. So it is a specialized and complicated system that you want to make sure you get people into the right hands that do this well and that evidence is protected. So we do everything we can to facilitate that transfer and support them in to the right people.
Claudia Covello, who is the executive director of the University Health Services at UC Berkeley. Denise Oldham joins us as well, the Title IX officer in the Office for the Prevention of Harassment and Discrimination. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning, Denise. I know you can't respond directly to the particular case that Sophie Karasik described, but on the broader question of this sense that there wasn't enough responsiveness, that it took, in her case, 7 months' time. Again, I know you can't respond specifically to her case, but what about that concern that there just isn't a quick enough response at UC Berkeley?
Well, first let me say that I understand that concern. We're grateful that our students have shown this kind of passion and commitment towards wanting us to do the best job that we can, and we're committed to doing that. What I can say generally about our investigations is that every investigation is different. The facts of the case, the number of witnesses that we may have, the reluctance of some of those witnesses, the amount of evidence that needs to be collected can all result in varying timelines for our sexual harassment and assault investigations.
Although the policy spelled out in the Department of Education memo that went out to all campuses in 2011, cites it, although it does say that these things can vary, they say on average investigation should take about 60 days.
That's correct.
So if Sophie is correct in saying that she didn't hear for 7 months, that would be problematic, right?
I'm sorry, say that again, please.
That would be a problem if it took 7 months and that was not, and the results of that investigation were not conveyed to the student who filed the complaint. That would be a problem.
We certainly would not want students to wait any longer than they needed to wait to hear from us. And again, without being able to speak to the specifics of that complaint, we're committed to looking into her claims and trying to figure out if there's anything that we could have done better.
And what about this general concern that seemed to be cited at the legislature this week? And you read about sort of nationwide, which is this sense of campuses not being receptive enough to people who are filing these complaints, that there's a sense that when people bring these concerns forward, that the university involved, and I'm not specifically saying this about UC Berkeley, but campuses in general, just aren't responsive enough, that they're saying, we don't really want to hear this. How do you respond to that very pervasive sense that you read about in college campuses all around the country?
Yes, we have been hearing this. And again, I can only speak for what I know here on our campus. And I would say that in terms of our overall approach, I think, again, I'm on a different side of the issue, but the opposite is true. Our programs, let me first say that there are many doorways students can walk through when they are bringing complaints to our attention. They can walk through the emotional support medical doorway. They can walk through the administrative reporting, filing a complaint doorway. There's a law enforcement doorway. On our campus, that would be campus police if it's in their jurisdiction, or if students are not living on campus, it would be the city police. And all of those response networks, in addition to our advocacy offices, who can guide students in the right direction, actually work together and try to make sure that we meet on a regular basis so that when we know of reports that one or the other has, to the extent that we can share information about those reports, that we're trying to make sure that students are receiving all the attention that they need and or are requesting from us. So, for example, if a student has filed a complaint in our office, we want to make sure that we've offered them all the emotional and medical support that might be necessary throughout the process and even afterwards, because recovery obviously doesn't end with the outcome of an administrative investigation.
Denise Oldham, who is with the University of California, Berkeley's Office for the Prevention of Harassment and Discrimination. Let me ask you both, Claudia Covello and Denise Oldham, just a last question about what, if anything, you're going to try to now do differently. The legislature wasn't very happy. The committee in Sacramento this week, Assemblyman Anthony Rendon said, as a state, we should not stand for this. People who wish to further their education should not be worried that sexual assault stands in the way. I'm sure you'd agree with that sentiment. So what do you want to say back, I guess, to Assemblyman Rendon and to the Sophie Karasics and other students who just don't feel that the UC campus is responsive enough?
So let me start, this is Denise, Dave, by saying first to the students, we hear you. We thank you for coming forward. We have the best students in the world, and we need to do our best to keep them safe and fulfilled in their education and not having to worry about the things that they obviously are worried about. So that's the first and most important message I would give to anyone, is that we do hear our students and that we care. And to the legislature, I think we certainly said this at the hearing, and we'll say it again. We welcome their concern, and we will work very, very carefully with them to be as open and transparent as possible and to learn from this kind of review.
And Claudia Covello, just very briefly, if you would, please, what are you going to do differently today?
We're going to improve our prevention. We have a vested interest in deterring sexual assault and violence in the first place. So we're committed to prevention through education and training and having this conversation and acknowledging sexual assault is a big problem and never acceptable. And we'll also redouble our efforts for communication and support of students.
Claudia Covello at the University Health Services, Denise Oldham in the Office of Prevention, Harassment, and Discrimination, both at the UC Berkeley. Thanks very much for participating in this important conversation.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We're going to widen out our conversation now and include some additional voices in it. Joining us now is Michelle Landa-Stauber. She's professor of law and professor also of sociology at Stanford University and the architect of a recently adopted sexual assault complaint and adjudication process at Stanford. Professor Stauber, thanks very much for being part of our program.
Thanks for having me.
And Scott Jasek joins us as well. He's the editor at Inside Higher Ed, which is a news website covering a variety of issues in higher education and has been reporting on this topic. Scott Jasek, thank you.
Good to be here.
Let's get a broader sense of this problem overall, and how the kinds of comments that you've been listening to in this first part of our program, how they resonate to you. Michelle Landis-Sauber, what struck you about what you were hearing about sort of the state of campuses right now and whether or not there is enough responsiveness to these concerns?
Well, first, I'd like to say that I think Ms. Karasik is really brave, and I commend her and the other victims around the country for coming forward and bringing their complaints to the Office for Civil Rights and the Department of Education, and for giving public statements about what is a very difficult topic to talk about in public. And I think she, as a young person, deserves a lot of credit for that. In terms of answering your question about how the Berkeley situation compares to schools around the country, this is an area where universities have been, I think it's fair to say, pretty slow out of the gate in a lot of institutions, and that is why you're seeing so many complaints being filed both by OCR, the Office for Civil Rights, and also by women who are organizing themselves, finding counsel, and, you know, have sort of an organized complaint-making movement going on.
Why do you think Why do you think that is? What
why
is
are
it?
Universities slow?
Yeah, I mean, you would think in a way that this would be
right.
The place where there would be the most sensitivity, the most responsiveness.
Well, I think it's a leadership question. I mean, all these places are different, but I will say that at Stanford, so just to back up and give a little bit of information, in 2011, the Office for Civil Rights issued what's called a Dear Colleague letter that let universities, it's like a mini regulation. You know, the agency is telling the universities and also school districts as well that it regulates, this is the expectation. And it gave them a set of expectations, many of which Ms. Karasik mentioned that Berkeley does not meet. And so in April of 2011, schools were sort of all across the country on notice that they had to make these changes. But at Stanford, we were sort of, I can just speak about my institution specifically, we were kind of ahead of that curve. Myself and an assistant general counsel and some other people at Stanford had started working on this issue in 2008, actually. And it took until this year, that is, it took between 4 and 5 years, even with a lot of concerted effort at Stanford, and then in the middle of that process getting support from OCR in the form of that letter, which was telling us we were going the right direction, it still took 5 years. I mean, it takes leadership. It takes commitment. We have a provost and a president at Stanford that were very committed on this issue. We had an infrastructure in place of people who leadership were very committed to seeing this get done and to continuing to work through the tough issues that come up when you start talking about sexual assault. And I think that if you don't have that leadership in place and that willingness to look very clearly and directly at maybe a past history that isn't, you know, necessarily flattering to the school, for example, part of our process at Stanford was that we compiled data that showed that in the 13 years prior to the revision to our program, we had had 175 sexual assaults that we reported to the federal government under the CLEAR Act, and we only had four.
Wow.
Four disciplinary hearings.
Let me hold you there because we have to take a short break. And when we return, we also want to get more information about how this problem is playing out nationwide. Scott Jasik can inform us of that because these problems are happening at very prestigious institutions all around the country, and we'll focus on what those institutions can do to bring about change when we return. We'd like your thoughts as well on this subject. If this is something that has touched your life in some way, join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum on KQED. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our topic this hour, the problem of sexual harassment, sexual assault, sexual violence on college campuses around the country, specifically here in California. A group of students from UC Berkeley testified before the state legislature this week that in their view, their concerns, complaints about this had not been adequately responded to by those at the university. And we're exploring during this hour how widespread a problem that is, what is it that campuses need to do to respond in a more effective manner. Again, according to a Department of Education memo citing statistics from the National Institute of Justice, 1 in 5 college women say that they have been the victim of a sexual assault or an attempted sexual assault during their time on campus. We are joined by Scott Jasek, who is the editor for Inside Higher Ed, a website covering higher education, and also by Michelle Landis-Dauber, professor of law and sociology at Stanford, who has worked on this issue. Scott Jasek, as you've listened to the conversation, this is a problem that you've reported on at any number of institutions around the country. What is the common denominator? Is it this question that women who file these complaints get into the process and then feel like this is just too difficult, too cumbersome, this is not something I really want to participate in? As Professor Landis-Dauber was just saying, at Stanford, they had something like 170 over a period of years and only 4 reached the adjudication process. Is that what you're seeing nationwide?
We're seeing all kinds of problems. I mean, one issue that hasn't come up today is we're seeing judicial systems on campus that were set up to deal with, say, plagiarism being applied to issues of sexual assault and rape. And I think a lot of the problems have taken place where it's important to remember, sexual assault and rape are crimes. They are violent criminal acts. And campuses that have a system set up to deal with academic disputes may mess up. That's a common problem. Institutions not following their own rules, which was mentioned by the woman from Berkeley, very common problem. Not all students are equal in many campuses. And for instance, a number of universities have been accused of protecting athletes or students who otherwise are somehow in a favored class. And so you have this whole infrastructure that may exist to protect some students who are being accused. So it's a wide range of problems, some of which were very consistent with what I heard from Ms. Karasik. And I think what's happening now is because more women are coming forward, more women are coming forward. I don't think sexual assault and rape are at all new issues. I think more women are standing up and telling their stories.
Scott Jasek, again, editor at Inside Higher Ed, and has been reporting on this topic. One of the things that correct me if I'm wrong about this, but it's my understanding, Scott, and then to you, Michelle Landis-Dauber, is that even if a criminal investigation takes place and let's say that the alleged perpetrator is found not to be guilty, that doesn't alleviate the university's obligation to still conduct its own investigation and still to do something about whether or not there is an atmosphere or a culture on campus that it's lending itself to these kinds of concerns. Is that right? The responsibility of the university is not strictly a legal one, Scott Jasek?
Absolutely. OCR has set
OCR
a different, the Office for Civil Rights of the Education Department, their standard for investigating complaints isn't the same as, innocent beyond a shadow of doubt. And likewise, campuses have an obligation to create an environment where things are less likely to happen. A university isn't presumed to be guilty because there is one perpetrator, but does a university have a system in place where rules are clearly stated? Does a university have a system in place where people who feel they are victims of sexual assault know what to do and who to contact? Is a system in place that it's clear these issues are taken seriously?
Mm-hmm.
All of those things are a university obligation, regardless of whether somebody's been convicted in a court of law.
We welcome your participation in our program this morning. If you've been someone who has this issue has touched your life in some way, we'd like to hear from you or anyone in our audience who has a question about this concern. Perhaps you're a parent who has a student going off to college for the first time and have a concern about that student's safety. You can join us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your thoughts on our Facebook or website. Michelle Landis-Tauber, I'm interested in Scott Jasek's point that sometimes campuses have judicial processes set up to deal with plagiarism or some other kind of issue, and that this is really a very specialized and different kind of both investigation and judicial process that has to be followed. Is that your sense, too, that you really do have to do something quite specific and quite particular to deal with this problem?
Yes, and I thought that was a good comment by Scott. That was exactly the situation that we had at Stanford, which is that we had a process that was set up to adjudicate complaints by faculty who have a lot of power against students who don't, and the system was set up really to equalize that power imbalance, say in the case of plagiarism where a faculty member has accused a less powerful student of cheating. So all the rights were unilateral. They were all given to the student. And then we used that model to adjudicate complaints of sexual assault, relationship violence, stalking, and other forms of harassment. And so what happened was that we learned that we had a process that was not welcoming and was intimidating women away. And that is how we got to 175 assaults that we reported under the Clery Act, which, may be an underreport because, there's a very high percentage of sexual assaults that are never reported to anybody.
The Clery Act being named after a young woman who was raped and murdered in Pennsylvania. If I might, I want to just change course a bit and focus in on one of Scott Jasek's other comments, and that's this question of culture and whether or not there is a culture at certain campuses that is protective of behavior that really shouldn't be protected. Scott, first, where have you found that to be the case? Where is there concern that there is a kind of rape culture or jock culture or something that makes this behavior more pervasive?
Well, at a number of universities, the people accused of sexual assaults, some of them, have been athletes. Now, I don't want to generalize and suggest that all athletes are rapists. They are, of course, not. But there is an infrastructure at most campuses with big-time athletics to help athletes with a range of problems. Likewise, at some universities, there is a culture where athletes are treated as people who don't have to follow all the rules. They don't necessarily have to show up at class every day. They get extra tutoring help. There's a whole, it's not just about sexual assault. I think there are places that send a message to athletes that say, you're not like everybody else.
And are there schools that are saying, are working hard to change that, who are bringing extra scrutiny?
Right now, for instance, there's a very interesting case at Vanderbilt where the university very quickly kicked out four students in an incident in which another student was raped in a dorm room. And so you see these incidents come up. Vanderbilt appears to have responded very quickly, and the case is now in the local judicial system. In other cases, there have been allegations that things weren't followed through with. There was a case at the University of Notre Dame where a woman killed herself shortly after filing a complaint against an athlete. The university and others never brought charges and say that the charges aren't appropriate.
And Scott,
these are very powerful people on many campuses.
And what do we know about the concrete numbers involved? I cited the statistic from the Department of Education memo from an Institute of Justice study, which says that 1 in 5 women report having dealt with attempted sexual assault or sexual assault during their time on campus. Do we know that that's changing? Do we know that the numbers are going up, going down? I know this is always a hard problem to get concrete numbers about. But what do you know about that, Scott?
I'm hesitant to say the numbers are up and down because sort of every study suggests that the numbers that many people don't report.
Right.
I think what we're seeing now that is different, and you heard this with your first guest today, is individual women telling their stories with their names attached to their stories. That has been the case at a number of the universities where complaints have been filed. When an articulate student at Berkeley or UNC Chapel Hill or Swarthmore gets up and tells her story, I think attention is paid in a way that hasn't been the case in the past. If you'd done this story 10 years ago, you might have been hard-pressed to
right.
find a woman identified to talk, as we heard earlier today.
866-733-6786 is our number if you'd like to join our conversation. Let's hear first from Ilan in San Francisco. Ilan, go ahead.
Hi. So I worked as a sexual assault response advocate on campus for 4 years when I was in university, and I continue working in this field today. It's really important to think that only 2 to 5% of people report. So when a university is doing something correct, their numbers go up, and they have to be prepared to actually be reporting more sexual assaults to the government, and that's a good sign. That means that you have put in place a system that's working where people feel as though they can come forward. Unfortunately, a lot of our systems are structured in a way that actually re-victimize the victim survivor and put a lot of pressure on them that's not a type of justice.
Ilan, thanks for the observation. It's underlines in some ways the point you were making earlier, Michelle Landis-Dauber, that universities, if they're going to respond in a more efficient, effective, and compassionate way, they have to be able to dig into their own past and be upfront about that. That sounds like the effort that you've tried to lead at Stanford, because in a way, what Ilan is saying is true. If you do this well, there's going to be more, not less, in terms of the number
right.
of cases coming forward.
That's right, and we were aware of that. I mean, I think that one of the things that schools have had difficulty with is that is treating rape like a civil rights issue, and I think that has created a big paradigm shift, and schools are having trouble, to get to your first question again, why aren't schools responding? Because everybody's against rape, but yet everyone is slow out of the gate. And I think that it's that rape has been seen for such a long time as sex, which it isn't, and as private, which it shouldn't be, rather than as a civil rights issue.
And why is that important, to see it as a civil rights issue beyond a criminal act?
Because there are laws that protect the rights of women to participate in an education on an equal basis to mm-hmm. male students. Now, I have to say that, of course, men can be victims of sexual violence as well, particularly in that athletic culture that the other guest was speaking about, so not to exclude them or diminish their experience. But the majority of sexual assault victims are going to be women. The majority of perpetrators are going to be men. And Title IX, which is a federal law, gives women the right to participate equally with men in these educational programs. And sexual assault, which is a severe form of sexual harassment that creates a hostile environment, is against the law. So the legal responsibility is that a school has to respond promptly and effectively to sexual harassment or violence. And if a school knows or reasonably should know about sexual harassment or sexual violence, then it has to take immediate action to eliminate the harassment, prevent its recurrence, and address its effects. And there are very specific ways that the Department of Education thinks that has to go. And a smart school will get out in front of this issue, which it doesn't, frankly, sound like Berkeley is necessarily doing at this time, and will, comply fully with those requirements immediately and put put the, you know, the past behind it.
Let me ask you this question from Michael in Oakland, who raises this. Why aren't victims of assault encouraged or directed to file a police report for formal handling of incidents? The university should not be in the business of policing all activities, but rather should take the outcome of formal police investigations and then apply a university response based on the student code of conduct. So, and where would you disagree with Michael, I guess, Michelle Landestauber, in terms of the importance of the university doing something in addition to whatever happens in the criminal process?
Well, universities, and this, by the way, also applies to high schools, secondary schools as well, and in my hometown of Palo Alto, California, OCR has just launched a full compliance review because of a highly publicized rape culture at our high school. So by no means is this limited to colleges and universities. But the Department of Education gives money to colleges and universities and school districts, and in exchange for that money, it has conditions about how that money can be spent. One of those conditions is that it has to protect the civil rights of, you know, on the basis of race, sex, you know, national origin, and other protected categories. In exchange for getting that money, the university has agreed to do those things. That's separate and apart from and has nothing to do with a criminal investigation. And let me just say that at Stanford, you know, of those 175 cases, virtually none of them involved a criminal process. So we do tell students about their right to report to the police, but a criminal process takes years to unwind. It involves a huge commitment of emotional energy by victims. Many victims find the criminal process to be re-victimizing. And they just don't want to go through that. I mean, you know, these girls are like, I didn't come to Stanford to be a witness in a criminal trial. You know, I just want to get on with my life. I want to put this behind me. I want to get my education. That's what I came here to get. And that's what they have a right under federal law to do, get their education.
Let's hear from another caller. Mike in Sacramento has a point he'd like to raise. Mike, go ahead.
I just had a question. You know, you can never say this comment without people looking at you as though you're the problem. But are there any... Does there any data exist that shows any maybe false accusations that may have been perpetrated against men?
Mike, thank you. Scott Jessick, why don't you take that one in your reporting? How often do false accusations take place?
Well, I'm not sure I would talk about false accusations as accusations where perhaps there's no proof. We've written recently about two lawsuits filed by male students or former students against universities that found them guilty of sexual misconduct, where they are claiming that they did not get due process. In these cases, it actually, some of the root of the dispute is the same issue we were talking about earlier. Did you have a judicial process that was not equipped to handle the allegations? Whenever we write about this issue, there are always some sort of men's advocate groups who claim that there is widespread false reporting. I have not seen convincing evidence of that. But what I see more common are complaints of just faulty systems all around.
And presumably, Scott Jessick, if the systems are in place in the right way, they will not only be fair to the person who has filed the complaint, they'll do a good job of being fair to the alleged perpetrator. I mean, if you have the right system in place, it's going to work both ways.
Right, and the problem is you don't have the right system. I mean, following up on my fellow panelists' comment about not treating this as, say, a civil rights act, you hear people talk about sexual assault as a, quote, he said, she said issue. And I think generally when you hear that, that's a good red flag that something's wrong, because that's why the rape kit issue that was talked about earlier is so important. The reality is in rape and sexual assault, there is typically physical evidence. It is not just he said, she said. And the idea that there are lots of women filing false reports, I just don't see evidence of that.
Patrick writes in, as a CSU East Bay student, what can we, meaning male students, do to help? What would you say, Professor Dauber? What would you like to see men step forward and do?
Well, I think that limiting it to just the terms of the question of getting a good policy in place, I think men need to be just as strong of advocates for policy reform at the institutional level as women. And that was absolutely the case at Stanford. The co-chair of the Board on Judicial Affairs with me was a male student. And we had many male students in student government who supported the policy change. It was not, I mean, many women students supported it as well, but it was, you know, across the board. Oftentimes, and I heard your Berkeley guest do this, you know, talk about, you said, well, what are you going to do differently? And she said, oh, we're going to do prevention. Prevention is important, and it's great, and we actually have an assistant dean at Stanford that's all they do, devoted to sexual violence prevention, but which is a great thing about Stanford. But the more important point about these policies is, you know, prevention's not going to be 100%. There are going to be sexual assaults, and federal law requires schools to deal with, you know, what happens when prevention fails and you have an assault. And so every school needs to have a compliant policy, a policy that implements Title IX. I think questions like the question from your caller about, well, what about, you know, false accusations? You know, Title IX has been a hobby horse of the right wing in this country for a long time. They hated it even when they thought it was just about sports, and they really hate it now that it's about rape. And so we need to recognize that Title IX is an important federal law. It's crucial to women's ability to get an equal education, and men need to step up. Male students and faculty need to step up and say, we support Title IX.
And again, as I think you both were indicating, if the process is set up in a fair and equitable way, it's going to be fair across gender. It's not going to be something that's going to result in only listening to those who are filing the complaints.
If I could just say something else on the prevention side, and this involves male students and female students for that matter, some campuses have stepped up their efforts to encourage students to intervene when they see something wrong. And campus culture doesn't always encourage that. If you see a man escorting a clearly drunk beyond ability to consent woman to a room, someone can say, hey, should you really be doing that? If you hear a woman shout, someone can intervene. And I think that changing the culture such that people are comfortable, even in a situation of a party, even in a situation where some people may be drunk, knowing that they have a moral and in some cases legal obligation to say, hey, no, don't do that. Some campuses are pushing that issue more. I'm amazed how many of these stories, and you know, that play out where it turns out so-and-so was watching or so-and-so was aware.
And we're taking a video.
That, taping a video. I mean, the worst example. There are a lot of people who aren't raping or assaulting who are in a position to do something.
So in a sense, just as you were applauding Sophie Krasik for stepping forward, and as you were saying, Scott Jasik, their willingness to be public and to be identified, that cuts all the way across in this, that people have to step forward and talk about this if they're male students on campus, step forward and do something if they see something, that's in the end what can really change the culture, Scott?
Absolutely. I mean, do you want a culture where people boast about having sex with women who are passed out? That's part of culture on some, you know, in some parts of American society, including some parts of campus life. But traditionally, I'm not sure students always intervene, and that's part of the discussion they're having. You know, did you hear something that makes you think somebody was assaulted? Did you do something? Did you tell the story about it?
I agree with you.
Didn't do anything. Yes.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say I agree with you, but I think another way you change the culture is by having clear, consistent rules, enforcing them, and giving reasonable consequences for bad behavior. You know, I think there's two parts. I think changing a culture is hard. Changing a policy and enforcing it is a way that you can get some leverage on that culture.
That brings me to a question from Margie gets at this question of what the policies should actually be. She says, having looked at some college policies on sexual misconduct, it appears that sometimes the survivors and the accused don't have the same procedural rights. In other words, sometimes it looks like the complainants have more rights in the process. Sometimes it looks like the respondents have more rights. Doesn't due process require equivalent rights? And I guess the question I want to take from what Margie has posed and just get very brief responses from you each on this is whether or not We have to think of this a bit differently than we think about judicial processes, which is not to say that it shouldn't be fair, but can we – do we need to craft something, Professor Daubert, that isn't quite so legalistic?
Well, at Stanford, if you look at the – first of all, you start with the law, so you look at the Dear Colleague letter. What OCR is saying is that in addition to specifying a burden of proof of preponderance of the evidence, which Scott mentioned, they also insist on bilateral rights. So I was very interested in hearing Sophie say that at Berkeley, you know, for example, she didn't even get to know the resolution and she didn't have obviously a chance to appeal it and things like that. And that is those are the kinds of rights that have to be given equally to both parties under the law. So that was interesting to me. At Stanford, we started from scratch, basically, and we created something called the alternate review process, and we lifted it out of what's a quite legalistic or sort of court looking like policy for dealing with plagiarism. And we said, okay, we're going to use that for those things over there, but we're going to create something completely new and different for sexual assault. And we have a Title IX investigator who is a trained sexual assault investigator who takes down statements from all the people, the witnesses, and writes up a report, and then that report goes to a smaller panel. Each party has the right to meet with that panel and be interviewed. The panel can interview witnesses, but the interviews happen separately. They don't happen in like a Perry Mason-style, you know, courtroom. So the girl in our previous policy, the victim had to be cross-examined directly by the alleged attacker. And as soon as women students heard about that part of the process,
they backed away. Yeah, let me hold you with there. It's good to get the sense of your policy, but I want to give Scott Jasek a last word on this in terms of what you're seeing again nationally, Scott, and where you're seeing campuses make the most strides.
Well, I think the Dear Colleague letter prompted a lot of campuses to look at their policies, as has the current attention. You know, I'm not in a position to say this is what an ideal policy should be, but when campuses have policies that don't give due process and don't give fair treatment to everybody, they end up with what they have now, which is places like Berkeley getting criticized for not being fair to their female students. If they have policies that don't get due process, they get sued by men who were found guilty of sexual misconduct. I think the current publicity is going to lead more campuses to say, hey, we need a system that works. And the reality is a lot of them don't yet have it.
And briefly, Scott, are there more schools like Vanderbilt that are cracking down, acting quicker when it comes to this whole question of the jock culture on campus?
You know, we see some of that, but then I'm never cease to be amazed that like 2 months from now, I'll hear about a case where something appears to have been covered up. I think the trends are all over the place, and I can't say that giving athletes special treatment has in any way ended in American higher ed.
Scott Jasek, editor of Inside Higher Education, also joined by Michelle Landis-Daubert at Stanford University. Earlier, we heard from Claudia Covello and Denise Oldham at UC Berkeley, and Sophie Karasik, the student who testified before the legislature this week. Thanks all very much for your participation in our program. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.